On training, and I can't stress enough, I'm not going to lecture you, but I have to say a little bit about the human resources and training, how important and what a sort of a cornerstone of all our efforts overseas, training and capacity building is. The numbers of healthcare personnel around the world in many developing countries, in resource-constrained countries, are extremely limited. In many cases, the training programs, whether it's university level or below level in terms of helping shape and form the people who provide healthcare in rural areas, for example, are often of very poor quality, and people don't really have mentorship programs. They don't have good opportunities to learn on-the-job skills. Are poorly supervised. So I think there is a lot of things that we can do. And so today, you're going to see several examples of this kind of endeavors that people, faculty from the university, are engaged in. We have a representation from the departments of neurology, urology, psychology, and cardiology, and the Vanderbilt International Office from the Center for Emergency. Adrián Jarquín Valdivia, Dr. Jarquín, is from the Department of Neurology. He's the founder of the International Visiting Scholars Program, which was designed to build strengths and strengthen working clinical educational research relationships between Vanderbilt University and international medical institutions, both public and private. So without any further ado, I introduce Dr. Valdivia to you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It is truly a pleasure to be here. This is the very first time I am out of my department speaking about this international visiting program, and it is truly a pleasure to do so. And some of it, what I'm going to be doing is give an overview of how this came to be, what we have done, and where we're headed. Our program is small, it's very modest, and hopefully with this sort of exposure, we are going to get increasing collaborations and expansion of the program. So when I first came here in 2002, late 2002, I had this idea that, well, I really would like to be able to offer the opportunities to senior medical students, early graduates from the medical school, young doctors, the opportunity to be able to come here to see how we're doing things, or to be sort of a platform, a bridge to their training in the United States. And I started looking for, I spent several months looking within Vanderbilt, asking questions to different people. It's like, is there something like this going on? And how can I make this happen? And eventually I came up with a series of documents, some of the stuff that I'm going to show you, to make sure that we were within the legal boundaries and then all the stones had been unturned, and make sure that everything was going to work okay. So we came up with this document that was hidden, so to speak, hidden or put away in a server at Vanderbilt. And after asking so many times to so many people, somebody said, oh, there is something about an observership document that somebody had put together in the 1990s at Vanderbilt. So I got a hold of it, and I looked at it. It's like, this looks pretty good, and this is Vanderbilt. It's been read and approved by a lot of people. So all I did is I changed the chairman. I put my chairman as one of the signing people, and then just updated who were the people in charge to sign this paper. So in one word, the observers come to observe. There's no direct patient care, direct patient contact. They can be with a team and go see patients with a team, be in the background, ask questions to the team members, go participate in the conferences, bring papers, participate in review article writing, stuff that we have done. For example, one of our Peruvian visitors, he wrote a nice review paper on the history of epilepsy in Peru. So, and that was in a paper that has been submitted to the journals. So this is ongoing. Although it began in 2004, it's been slowly moving forward, not growing, just moving forward. So the idea was to provide clinical experience that would lead to cross-pollination, where we would teach and we would learn from how they do things in other places. Aiming also to build and strengthen international ties for education, research, and clinical collaborations. And to serve as a bridge for further training, particularly to those that want to, for those that want to go back. So when the applications come in, and I review what's in the application, the CV, and their personal statement, I aim at okaying the observership for those that tell me that they are going to train and go back to their country. Those that want to come and stay, I'm not all that interested in, although we have accepted some of those too. In general, the observership is 2 to 8 weeks long, one scholar per cycle. That's all our department can accommodate for because of physical constraints, etc. So we have about one a month, so about 10 to 12 a year. We don't charge them for their stay here. And once we okay the candidate, then we provide a letter saying you've been accepted to come from this period to this period, and they can use that letter to obtain their visa. We do not provide any transportation or housing, so the candidate has to have some means of providing for that for them. They all have to complete the HIPAA training before they set foot in here, and there is a website, a Vanderbilt website for non-Vanderbilt people that is hooked up to our website. All need to have health insurance. All have to. We have to have their complete immunization record. So far, we have had scholars, senior students, most of them have been young doctors, recently graduated doctors from about 15 countries. And these are some examples from them. From Nicaragua, one, Pakistan, about two, India is probably the one country where we receive the most, one from Nepal, a couple from Iran, one from Thailand, two from Mexico, a couple from Colombia, Spain, Peru, Romania, two from the country of Georgia. And so it's been very satisfying to be able to establish and help these young people. Let me see if I can get to the website from here. This week is my last week as the director of the program. I am passing this on to Dr. Amir Arain, who is now the director of the program. In this website, we have the forms, which are PDF forms that they need to download and complete, and that states the aims of the observership, the definition of the observership, and all the details of the observership. There is also the Vanderbilt Observation Agreement. And the HIPAA website connection for them to complete their requirement with HIPAA. So that is our modest program. And if you guys should have any questions or comments about what we're doing.
What's the name of the new director?
I'm sorry?
What's the name of the new director?
Amir Arain. Bring it back up.
I have a question, actually. Do you keep track of the outcomes of the people that you have trained now?
I know of some that have already, they are in residency right now in the United States. Some have gone back to their country to try to finish the paperwork. So we haven't really done a good job of keeping track of what happens after mm-hmm. they come here.
Mm-hmm. When they actually observe while they're here, what kinds of procedures?
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, what they it's a clinical observership. So they come, they get assigned to a clinical team. They go on rounds in the on the wards. Then they go to the conferences, and if there are procedures or MRI reading or muscle biopsy reading, they can be during in those activities. And that occupies them a lot of time. They do get an ID badge, and the ID badge gives them access to the library. And so they have access to the internet and their email access and so on through the library.
The issue of motive. How many of your overseas visitors are looking to enhance their clinical skills apply when they get back home versus how many of them are looking for a nice addition to their CV to make it easier for them to emigrate to the U.S.? Do you have an instinct for that?
I'm going to say that most of the observers are looking at getting a recommendation letter to be able to apply to a residency program in the United States. About 50% of them have already passed their USMLEs. And typically, I accept the higher scores, the 90 and higher scores. So that sort of filters a certain intellectual level. But how many are just looking for a CV building by doing this? I cannot really tell you because we haven't kept track of what happens afterwards.
And what about, sort of an allied question, what about institutional partnerships for this program? I know you told me about the Mexicans and how they were contemplating a more formal relationship, and they were even thinking about renting an apartment.
Exactly.
And having people come repetitively through the year.
Yeah.
That evidently hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. But what would be the upside and downside of, rather than offering it to the world, sort of nurturing a couple of sites in which you or neurology faculty or other faculty for that matter have this particular institutional interest?
You know, I really appreciate the question, and part of my answer, and this is more of a personal feeling than anything else, you know, I believe that making this available sort of a wide net will allow for some of the smartest people in many countries to participate and hopefully to build also our reputation across the world, not just in one place. And I have thought many times about doing both rather than just doing one or the other. But we haven't gotten to that point of being able to just nurture a single line. And the line that I was most interested in for some time, I still remain very interested, has been China, to establish a relationship in China, but that hasn't fully flourished yet. Not that I know of, and somebody else may
well,
may want to.
You'll hear about at least two this afternoon. But neurology has sort of been ahead of the curve, which is why we wanted Adrian to essentially share the multi-year experience.
And one interesting thing is that we have never advertised this, and either locally or anywhere else. These guys that send the applications and we get one a week or two a week, they Google where they can go to an observership and they come up with us. And then word of mouth, I guess, from those that have been here.
Do you have an institutionalized plan for following up on this phone to check in?
No, we do not have a plan, but I think we need to have a plan. And I appreciate your question and your insisting on having it happen.
Roger Chalkley upstairs has an amazing system for following up postdocs, and he would be the person to talk to.
Okay.
I think Roger would be happy to advise you.
Okay.
Yes. Got any positive or negative feedback from the medical students or how staff were interacting
Yeah, the verbal feedback has been that they appreciate having somebody struggling through the language and through the concepts and through the mnemonics that we use and hearing how they do it somewhere else from these observers. So in ways, I feel satisfied that we have been able to cross-pollinate from medical students up on the different visions of the same problem, sort of an intersection. You know, bringing the intersection to occur by doing this.
Sort of a follow-up for that, have you thought about collecting feedback information from each of the observers to see how it could work better for them or what else, you know, how do they see doing something better for them?
Well, I do an exit interview with each one of them, and I have collected several thoughts and ideas on how to do it better, including having a website of where they can stay or how they can get funding on how to come here, etc. But that isn't actually seen here, but that is on my hard drive. It hasn't been just posted. Mm-hmm. But that is available in a PDF format.
Okay, I think we have one more question.
You know, I am a foreign medical graduate also. I am originally from Nicaragua, but I trained in Honduras. And I guess some of what you see here is the reflection of the stress that I had to go through when I was going through the steps of coming here, that probably some of you had to go through. And I guess I tried to read in between the lines on the CV what's going on here. Is this true? I go to the web site and check to see if the medical school exists and what sort of medical school it is. Like the Georgian, the medical school, I didn't know that it existed, but it so happens that these guys that are coming, now we have three of them, have been from the best medical school in Georgia. So we don't go through the Interpol or anything like that to try to figure out if they have a criminal record or anything. So far, we haven't run into any trouble. But, the risk exists, but I think there is a risk in not doing it also.
You mentioned something very interesting, signals a little bit of a pathway in how the university may want to pursue this. You mentioned, and also it had to do with Dr. Vermont's question about establishing potentially a collaborative site where you would actually send faculty to do in-country training versus over here. It also points to me that maybe we are at a different stage. You've been bringing people over here that would help sort of build Vanderbilt's name internationally. And I don't know, maybe Joel, you would like to comment a little bit on that later. There is also the opportunity of using sort of the established partnerships that the university already has created with a number of other institutions and trying to see what potentially could be a good way to move this agenda forward. But thanks very much. That was very interesting. Our next speaker is Mr. Steve Guillot. He's the director of the National Center for Emergency Preparedness here at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center. And the goal of the organization is to create new tools to fight terrorism and help communities be better prepared for large-scale disasters. So let me introduce Mr. Guillot.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. As mentioned previous, the Center for Emergency Preparedness was created here at Vandy in 2002 to take a look at emergency preparedness in healthcare, emergency preparedness in the community, as well as emergency preparedness abroad. And since the establishment of this particular center, we've done quite a bit of work abroad, both in Europe, in the current theater in the Persian Gulf, as well as in other countries. And I'll comment through that as I go through the slides here. You can see the mission of the center to look at comprehensive educational programs, not only in the state of Tennessee, not only in the United States, but abroad. How much do I believe in that? I am currently a PhD student in Europe. I have a master's in disaster medicine from Europe. So I'm kind of doing the opposite of what some of the other presenters have done with their profession. Some of the expertise that exists here at Vandy, we leverage the center to where we develop certain capabilities. We leverage the expertise within the medical center and also within the university side to bring those experts with us in the field, whether it's in the States or abroad. More or less the system that we follow, education and training, they'll call us for technical resources, clinical education and operational research, and we can look at recognized expertise in this particular arena to get the jobs or the mission accomplished. Some of the work we're currently doing with the Tennessee Department of Health, also some of the work we're doing abroad, looking at mass casualties related to chemical response or any type of chemical terrorism, radiological response or any radiological terrorism. The big buzzword now with the federal government is NIMS compliance, looking at any type of national incident management system. HICS is another program that we're conducting throughout the state. And kind of ironic, last week I received a call from CENTCOM, which is the U.S. Central Command, and we'll be conducting this particular program in Jordan the week of March the 2nd through the 6th. And then Ms. Carol Etherington, who's in the audience here, was working with us and looking at the psychological impact of disasters to the community and also to hospital operations. Another one that we have here within another organization housed within the center is the Medical Reserve Corps. How do we look at major disasters within the United States and abroad and take you as a healthcare professional and get you engaged in a particular incident, get you involved, credential you to be able to participate in these disasters? For instance, during Katrina, we were able to put 306 people to work with over 3,000 man hours during that particular disaster. Some of the other projects we're working, you can see a START program to where we reach back into research institutions worldwide to help the U.S. government answer questions related to areas of concern. The other thing you can see we work with the Center for Public Health Preparedness within the U.S. Health and Human Services. I mentioned the European program where we have folks with WHO and PAHO working with us there. It is housed in Italy, in Novara, Italy. We're within the United States now, they have three U.S. partners, Vandy, Yale, and Harvard, which I probably consider pretty good company when you're going to take a look at some of that. Within the last class that we're teaching at this particular program, there were 23 countries represented worldwide when we conduct seminars within this particular setting. The other one that they asked me to talk a little bit about today is our designation as a Pan-American Health Organization or as a PAHO Center of Excellence, and I'll talk a good bit about that. And then the last one you see here is the Tennessee Homeland Security, to where we have the universities within the state of Tennessee working together for a common cause. And looking at the WHO Collaborative Center, we've been designated to be the Center for Emergency and Disaster Preparedness within the Pan-American Health Organization. Some of the capabilities and some of the things they want us to take a look at is developing multidisciplinary teams that can go out and work with the public health sector, hospitals, the military, state and federal, and then our international partners. Our specific geographic region that we're currently working on, number one is the U.S. itself, number two is the Caribbean, number three is Central and South America. So we will be calling probably on some of you in this room to assist us in some of those endeavors. Again, we look at systematic development, preparedness, and crisis leadership as we look at the healthcare workforce during any type of mass casualty incident. In developing the ties abroad, the center is able to get what we commonly call boots on the ground information in dealing with disasters abroad, with the tsunami, with other type of large disasters in different countries. We can get quite a bit of information out of those countries that we can use for some of the research that we're doing, and also look at policy and procedural changes in some of our activities that we're currently doing. Here is where we're taking a look at outcomes. Most of us in looking at disaster preparedness abroad, we've been to a lot of courses, we've been to a lot of training, we've been to a lot of things. It's time for us to look at how do we take, and what I commonly call is a progression approach or a career path that we can help folks get from point A to point B in this particular field. And that's what we're doing here, looking at performance objectives and evaluation. The other thing, we can look at the healthcare system, we can look at the healthcare professionals. Also, we need to engage the citizens and educators in that community to plant some seeds that when we leave, we know some follow-up is going to take place. And we're going to also include professionals, elected officials, clergy, and so forth to get the community wrapped around this particular problem and also to address some of the critical issues in looking at how do they become a more resilient community. We need to follow some of that line of thinking in this country. We look at clinical outcomes and measure to assess efficiency and effectiveness of the healthcare and looking at any type of countermeasures that's going to affect adults, children, and looking at pre-event, during an event, and post-event of any type of disaster that may affect some of these communities. These are some of the seminars that we're doing stateside and also some of the seminars that we're planning on doing in some of our area that's been assigned to us by PAHO. You can see a lot of our work is primarily focused on incident management, emergency management, emergency planning, in those specific areas. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Obviously, this is a very potentially high profile and potentially high impact initiative that you would have been selected by PAHO for this developmental center status, and hopefully in a year or two or three we'll have full WHO accreditation as a collaborative center. What is the balance between reactive and proactive work in this center? In other words, I know the reactive part. An event occurs and you are better prepared than any other part of Vanderbilt, I presume, to offer a network of services. But the proactive part, the training in disaster preparedness, a curriculum, a master's degree in disaster preparedness, a specialty track for nursing, give us a little sense of what that's all about.
In looking at where do we go from here to get on the path that you're talking about, and looking at a community first, one of the first things we want to take a look at is hazard vulnerability assessment and also some of the plans that are in place, making sure that the training and also equipment that's being purchased to respond during incidents is the right equipment and money spent wisely. And then after that, building the capabilities within a community to be able to respond to the potential events identified in the hazard vulnerability assessment would be extremely important. Having plans in place, having training that matches the plans, having exercises that match the trainings that match the plan. Those are some of the things that we're working in some of these foreign countries as we go in. How do we take that and put it into a master's program? How do we take that and put it into any type of certificate program and so forth? What are the things we're gradually doing within the School of Nursing? It's looking at how do we build an emphasis on some type of disaster preparedness, disaster medicine type of program. And then we introduce the actual concept of planning, response, mitigation, and also taking a look at building some type of resilient community. Currently, we're looking at three courses, a week-long program to do building School of Nursing. Hopefully, we're going to increase that. We're also in the forensics program within the School of Nursing and building that particular capability there because there's some relationship between forensics and disaster preparedness.
Forgive me, forensics and pathology, I understand. Forensics and the School of Nursing, explain that to me.
Forensics in the School of Nursing is where we're from what I'm gathering from this particular instructor, is we're looking at abuse. We're looking at child abuse, sexual abuse, type of forensics, and dealing with law enforcement, which is a little bit different than what you're talking about.
The death scene.
So Carol's old career.
Well, the interesting thing is the death scene investigation. They work at the coroner's office. They work on a lot of things, but the lap over of the disaster with the mass casualties.
Sure, I can see that.
Whether it's a man-made intentional disaster or a natural disaster.
I actually have an acquaintance who was the state epidemiologist for Indiana. You may recall the American Airlines small flight on its way to Chicago in a terrible storm, what was it, 6-7 years ago, and went down, killing everybody in the plane. And the forensics piece there was that the state health department, with a number of partners, had to find the body parts and figure out, body parts lying all over the region and figure out who could be buried, who could be identified, personal effects. And, it was a Kafkaesque experience. And he told me that his lack of experience in doing anything similar to this made it that much harder to, achieve the goal. He had to recruit people with expertise on no notice, so that's an interesting point.
A few years ago, there was a little bit of an uproar and a global response global emergencies, and the proposal that the military establishments would play a bigger role in dealing with crises. Has that changed? I'm not really sure. I don't hear much talk about that from the point of view. The emphasis is on preparedness, but not so much on the response, the crisis, and what other agencies, what role could other people play.
The U.S. system is exactly opposite of what most of the rest of the world uses. In the U.S. system, in looking at disaster management, we start with the local community and put them in charge, and everybody else's support. The
the state is to play a support role to the locals. The feds is to play a support role to the state, to play a support role to the locals. Abroad, we have a top-down management system. Of course, most of your countries, as most of you know, are decided by state. And a top-down management system is a lot easier to push policy, to push procedures, to push resources down. There's pluses and minuses to both. Katrina was probably the closest you've seen in this country to the federal government taking over an incident. That is a rarity. I don't think you're going to see the system change in this country that quick. So you still have locals engaged, locals involved. For instance, if something happened here in Nashville, the Office of Emergency Management right off of 15th of Belmont is going to be the coordinating agency for any type of event here, not FEMA, which is about Armory over there. It's a little different. And that's what, in studying abroad and spending quite a bit of time abroad, gives me an appreciation to, wait a minute, there are other ways to manage incidents, to manage disasters than what we do. And that's why I appreciate the first speaker bringing in the observers to watch. There are other ways to do things. How do you do things with almost nothing? Compared to an environment that we're used to, you pick up the phone and something shows up. And we get kind of spoiled sometimes. And realizing that a resource, you can call for it, but it never shows.
Yeah, I kind of really appreciate the issue of the trade-offs. You know, there is certainly some kinds of knowledge that you are only going to get from the people on the ground. And, you know, they are need to be involved in the guiding. But there is resources that, you know, need to be accessed from outside the area. And so that's when you're pulling on other agencies.
You know, the first time we've seen foreign governments coming in this country in any type of magnitude was Katrina. And bringing in foreign responders to our mainland. We're used to going abroad. We have teams to go abroad. NGOs, non-government agencies, non-government associations that do a lot of work abroad. So,
any other questions?
Katrina, because it was the first time the federal government stepped in, the military stepped in. And looking at dealing with natural disasters is probably a better way of looking at how do we manage things, a tornado, a flood, and having the local agencies engaged.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Joel Harrington, Assistant Provost in charge of overseeing Vanderbilt's international strategy and office, a vast responsibility that includes identifying institutional needs and opportunities and developing selective international partnerships at the university, school, and department levels. And he coordinates this with a number of faculty and through an advisory board. Dr. Joel.
I'd like to thank Alfredo and Sten and all their colleagues at IGH for inviting me to speak to you today. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of what are a lot of things going on at the university. And I think you're getting one sense today of just how much is going on. Multiply that by many times. And what I'd like to talk is about some of the ways that we're all working together. That this is a very collaborative venture across the campus to find out what each other is doing and to find ways that we have common interests and common resources to work together. So virtually everything I say to you today, you can find online if you go to the Vanderbilt homepage and click on International. And that's our website, which is almost going to be overhauled next week. So there'll be a new version next week. Internationalization goals, these are things which come very strongly from the leadership of Chancellor Guy. I actually work for the provost. But I work with all the deans across the campus regularly, work with all my faculty colleagues and staff colleagues around the university. Again, it's a very collaborative venture, and there's just so much going on that what we've decided to do is, and this is relatively new, this is in the last few years, to try to have a strategic approach, that is to find out, number one, what's going on among our own faculty and students, number two, what they'd like to have going on, and number three, a way that we can pool resources and do this in a strategic way. So the goals are pretty simple. It's enhancing international education, broadly speaking, for all the students, undergraduate, graduate, and professional. This includes a variety of programs. And we have a new global education office whose mandate has expanded to offer assistance to graduate and professional students. This was previously just an undergraduate office. And if we have time in the questions, I can say more about that. Also facilitating greater international research and teaching opportunities. Obviously, all of our colleagues are involved in lots of things. It's a question, though, of maybe helping other people make contacts or doing things together in a new way and making contacts with colleagues at foreign institutions to open up new doors. And in general, improving Vanderbilt's reputation around the world. And this is something we all have an interest in. It's not only good for our ego and self-esteem, but it's also good for us when we're recruiting faculty, when we're recruiting students, when we're approaching corporations and foundations about funding, and all the things that you would associate in the U.S. with making a strong university. We're trying to do this more aggressively and more focused in an international context. I'll mention a few major points of things that we're doing, focusing on a university and school level strategies. And this is something that I'll mention we have an advisory council that's ACIA, which includes representatives from around the university. The medical center is very ably represented by Sten and Alfredo and Carol Etherington and Jeff Andrews, and we have other people come in. We talk about things that are going on. We try to make some collective recommendations on things. But one of those is that we work, on the one hand, on a university strategy, but at the same time that each of the schools develops a strategy which overlaps with that. In other words, and this will be especially important when I talk about institutional partners, that is that there are some things that we can do as a university that benefit people around the university. There are others which are much more specific to the interest of a school. So that involves working with the dean, the faculty, and students within those schools. We created the Vanderbilt International Office. If you know where Alumni Hall is, a surprising number of people don't. It's right next to Alumni Lawn, amazingly, behind Kirkland Hall. And this is intended as a hub for activity. We work very closely with the IGH that we try to keep apprised of things that are going on to help other people, to work especially with services, the various service units around the university about bringing in people or sending people abroad, delegations and a variety of other things that I'll tell you about. So I hope you'll sometime come by or at least check out our website and feel free to contact the office about anything, because if we don't know the answer, we most likely know the person or the office that will, and we can help you with that. And that's one of the goals of the office, is sort of an information note. Strategic core partners I'll talk about in a minute. This is something relatively new. We've only been doing this for about 2 years, not even, about a year and a half. And increasing the number of international students and faculty, this is especially a priority among undergraduates. We do roughly about as well as other research universities at the graduate and professional level. We can do better. We can be more diverse. But we lag behind in undergraduates. And that's something that our new dean of admissions has made a big priority to recruit a lot more students from around the world. To make this really a global university in that sense, that you do have that kind of representation among the undergraduates. So these are all goals that are both distinctive but also interrelated. Core partners, this is something I'll try to summarize. I'll try to say briefly. The idea being that all of us, many of us in the faculty, have partners around the world that we work with on a ad hoc, on a regular basis. And the idea of a core partner is to develop some institutional relationships. That is, that Vanderbilt develops a relationship with a few universities or institutes around the world, something that will transcend individuals, that will last beyond individual relationships, something that will carry over to benefit lots of people other than those individual relationships. And what we've decided to do, this is the council being the driving force, but also the various deans, is to focus on less is more. That is, rather than have a lot of superficial institutional relationships, we're going to try to have a few deeper ones, more profound and more enduring with fewer places. And I'll emphasize that, again, we're doing this at a core level for the university, as well as the schools are starting to do this on their own, and these will overlap. The idea of a core university is a place that we think offers the most potential benefit for our faculty and students. So the key criteria there will be a research prominence. It has to be obviously a peer institution, broadly defined. Disciplinary breadth, that is, it has to offer many of the same areas that we do and be excellent in all of those. And that's not easy, I'll tell you that, because most universities tend to be stronger around the world in a few areas. Having the kind of breadth that we do, and Vanderbilt has 10 schools, is uncommon, and being strong in all those is uncommon. And then strategic locations. We try to do this in different regions around the world. Have a few partner, a partner or two in each of the regions. Obviously, this is selective. It's a big world. There are lots of great places out there. So there will be universities that you may work with or want to work with that are not on this very short list. That said, the international office and I would work to support any kind of collaboration that you have. The difference is that we've decided there's a potential benefit to a lot of faculty and students with these institutions, and that we've entered into agreements with them where we've each decided to devote special resources to encourage that kind of collaboration. The potential benefits for faculty and students and for the institution are that by developing this stronger relationship with the institution, they can help us more in the region with corporations and foundations. They can help us in ways that extend beyond research, and just as we help them. Most of all, that this is a sustainable relationship that again, lasts, because people come and go. And we wanted to build something on a more sustainable foundation. The four that we currently have are University of Cape Town, University of Melbourne, Fudan University in Shanghai, and University of Sao Paulo. These are all excellent universities. They all have medical centers, very strong. But again, it's not an exclusive relationship, and I designed this Venn diagram since I see the world in Venn diagrams. And the main thing is the individual and group collaborations is the most important thing, and that's something that I and my office work to support in any way that we can. I'll talk about that. But also that these will overlap, some of them, with core partners for the university and with strategic partners for the school. And so there will be special encouragement and help for those people, because then it not only helps the individual researcher, it also helps Vanderbilt in building this institutional relationship. So that's the way I imagined it in my head. I'll mention two types of resources that I can offer. One of them, and these are very modest seed grants, but I think we found that they can actually be good motivators. The idea being that if you or a colleague at a foreign institution decide you're working together, you'd like to maybe develop something more standing, something more permanent, maybe involving an exchange of graduate students, we have some grants that you can apply for to explore that. And all the information about these grants can be found if you go to international on the Vanderbilt homepage. There's a description of that. The grants are $4,000. Just for an initial trip that Sten may decide he needs to go over and talk to somebody and talk to their colleagues, spend a couple days there, start pounding things out, doing more things than you could do via email or telephone. And then we see what happens from there. There's also an exchange for graduate students, postdocs, and faculty. Again, very modest, but enough to bring people in for a little bit longer. And that's up to $15,000 in matching funds. To build that collaboration and that relationship. Ultimately, if any of these projects grow, they're of course going to depend on extramural funding, just like everything else. But this is just to encourage people and to help people get things going. Summarizing some of the other support services that the International Office, or we call it VIO, Vanderbilt International Office, offer various information. As I said, we work with all of the international offices around the campus, Some of them are directly part of our structure, some of them are indirectly. We also work with all the academic programs. I won't ever pretend that we know everything that's going on. And anybody who tells you they know everything going on internationally at Vanderbilt is pulling your leg, because it's impossible. We probably know as much as anybody else, though, and probably more. And I encourage you to tell us if you know of things going on so that we can help other people and maybe also help you. We will facilitate in various ways research collaborations and exchanges, including working with you to identify funding resources that you may not know about. Many of the agencies, both in the U.S. and outside, have identified international collaborations as a particular focus and something they wish to encourage. I'll be clear, we will not write the grants for you, but we will help you find them, and we'll work with your foreign partners. And this is another idea, that if we work with these core partners, that you are eligible then for the funding in that country as well as in this country. We'll also work to help you with visiting scholars and researchers. We do not have dedicated housing on Vanderbilt, and this is something all of us have talked about a lot, but we do have resources to help you find housing and some other things involved in settling people in. The Medical Center also has resources for that. Visiting delegations, we can help you with that in terms of itineraries and meetings. And if you are interested in developing new study abroad courses, I don't know that this would necessarily apply for the medical school, nursing school, but courses don't have to be just the regular courses for credit. There are a variety of programs that are academic, service, and mixtures of academic and service. And so if you're interested in exploring some of those, I encourage you to talk to me or to the people at our global education office. So I will now stop, and I did get a late start. So I'll take a few minutes for questions.
Or the other.
Thank you very much, Joel. That was great. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Ahmad Abu Halima, a Vanderbilt Interventional Cardiologist, Cardiology Fellow, currently working with Jordan University and Jordan Royal Medical Services to establish two training programs at Vanderbilt, an exchange student training program and a program in Jordan that is assigned to enhance physician competency in cardiology, at which will be the expanded to the to rest of the specialties in medicine and surgery.
Thank you, sir. I'm so unhappy that you pronounced my name the right way, honestly. And I'll tell you why now, because I was hoping that you would not, but I'm going to add you to this list now. These people, in fact, and that's why I was hoping to compare you to this list of people. So on this list of people, actually, they are the people that they can pronounce my name exactly like my mother does. And on top of them is Dr. Vermund, which you all know. Rob Krausman, who is, aside from being like an older brother to me, he is chief of Rhode Island Medical Board and licensure. He was program director for internal medicine Brown for eight years. Sidney Bremen, who was chairman of CHEST at the time, and he was chief of division of pulmonary critical care in Brown. Dr. Vaughan, our chief of cardiology here in Vanderbilt. Alberto is a very good friend of mine. He is an internist now. He was my medical student and a resident for many years in Brown. Jeff and Dr. Rani both are one of our faculty in cardiology here. Now, the thing in common between all of these people, other than pronouncing my name right way, and other than being physicians, they are all walked in a bridge like this. Or some of them walked in that bridge literally. This is Newport Bridge on Rhode Island, actually. And a few years ago, we decided to make this bridge to extend beyond, you know, ending in Rhode Island and to go across the Atlantic to end up in Jordan. And that's when we decided to build that medical educational bridge. And I'm not going to go through this because Dr. Harrington probably mentioned every aspect why do we build medical bridges, but enhancement of Vanderbilt international reputation is very good. When I joined the fellowship, a few of my friends asked me, where are you going to do your cardiology fellowship in? And I said, Vanderbilt. And they said, oh, yeah, is it a good place? And I was, like, disappointed really big time. Because if you go and ask anybody, even the common people in the Middle East, which is the best university in the United States, they will tell you Harvard. Maybe they don't know it's in Boston, but they know it's Harvard. Because Harvard has been there. Harvard has wonderful and strong reputation internationally. And one of the reasons we need to build medical bridges is to make people know that Vanderbilt is as good as Harvard. Maybe, you know, when I went to Jordan a few months ago to build our new medical bridge with the Royal Medical Service and, you know, with cardiology, only few people know at that time that Vanderbilt Heart Institute was among the top 20 in the U.S. News and World Report. And that's a great achievement. But we need people to know where we are. We need people to know what Vanderbilt is, and that's one of the most important reasons to build these bridges. Now, enhancing medical care and health care for countries abroad and for ourselves also is a very important point. The Education Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, which is the mother institution for all the foreign graduates, including myself, was established many, many, many years ago, and they were offering an exam called VQE exam initially, called Visa Qualifying Exam. If you pass that exam, you get green card when you get the residency here. And then they made it something called Exchange Visitor Visa Program. And their whole point is to train physicians coming from foreign countries with obligation to go back to their countries at least for 2 years to give what they trained here in to their own countries. Many of them do not go back, myself included, honestly. But again, that was the initial proposal why this establishment was done. And that inspired lots of people, and myself included, in doing something like this. Now, if we send our students also, healthcare starts by the medical student and goes through the house staff and through the physicians. If we go overseas, we're going to see, you know, some diseases we don't see or we use not to see in this country. But now it's becoming one country, not a small world anymore. So you see everything. You're going to see patients moving to this country, moving to Nashville, Tennessee, that they have diseases you did not hear about. And that's very important. And I have a medical student that I was so honored that I worked with when he was a medical student with me. He did some clerkship in countries overseas, Egypt and Jordan. And last week I told him about a patient that I cath, that this patient's from Somal, and he has white pulse pressure and arterial venous malformations, and that's the only thing I told him. And I asked him, what do you want to do with this patient? So he said, I want to examine him to make sure he doesn't have spider nevi, no liver failure, and I want liver enzymes for him. And he hit that nail on the head. Because he, from being in Africa for a few months, he knew that schistosoma infection is widely spread there, and these patients get liver cell failure, and that will give them heavy malformations. And he's practicing here. I can assure you he does not ask for MRI for every patient coming with him for headache. So these expertise, we have all the toys in this country, but that's also affecting us that we lack some of the history and physical basics of medicine. So that's another important thing. Now, observership, as Dr. Adrian was mentioning, observership is a very good thing. I was betting badly with observership in 1998 when I came from my country to do observership in this country. And it's very good. You're seeing lots of stuff, but you do not have hands-on. Then you have to pass the USMLE. And for that reason, we built our first bridge. And it started by a friend of mine asking me what's the difference between, Jordan and United States. And I told them, well, that's the only difference. You guys have deer crossing, we have camel crossing. But that tells you a lot. Like, who's moving fast and who's moving slow. We just for the sake of time, the first program we established was between Brown University, Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine, and the Royal Medical Services of Jordan, which has basically treats almost half of the Jordanian population. It's a very academic place, goes hand in hand with the University of Jordan. That program was called Added Competency Training Program in Pulmonary Critical Care Medicine for physicians of the Royal Medical Services. And the program was basically few months of medical training, ranging from 1, 3, 6, or 12 months for these physicians. The goal of the program is everything we mentioned before. And we made sure that we're going to bring also very good physicians to represent their country. So on the side of the Royal Medical Services, the training office there was led by one of our friends who actually graduated from Mayo Clinic. He's an internist. And he is personally selecting who goes and who does not go. You have to be, you know, on top of your class. And then, if you have USMLE degree or ECFMG certificate, then you're fine. We'll get you a license. Then Rob Krausman work for these people who does not have USMLE certificate or ECFMG certificate. If they have Jordan Board of Internal Medicine or its equivalent, or MRCP from the United Kingdom, they can get a limited license as a trainee there in pulmonary critical care. Financially, they were all supported by the Royal Medical Services, including housing, their health insurance, malpractice insurance. Everything was paid up front. The U.S. Embassy in Amman was so generous with us. They helped us to establish O visas for all these trainees. They were guaranteed they're going to go back. This is one of the most important things. We are training them so they can go back and give their expertise there. And they are working for the Army. They cannot not go back. And because the Army is sponsoring them financially for at least a year here, they have to work there for at least 2 years. So that was working well. And critical care medicine was part of anesthesiology in Jordan. After this program, it became, there was a new program now called pulmonary critical care in Jordan. All the graduates now, they have Jordan Board and pulmonary critical care. And everyone should do a year at Brown and another year in Jordan. So that worked well. And to be honest also, that also gave us the chance of selecting some of these international graduates that we might recruit them in the future. And also gave us the opportunity to start doing research between our both institutions. My study will be much stronger if I have 5,000 patients, not only 2,000. And also, it will be a good chance to treat them how to do research and to show them how research is really done in the proper way. So it's been working fine, and they have 3 graduates so far in the past 3 years. All of these graduates are coming to fulfill an non-ACGM accredited program, so they don't interfere with our own students or our house staff. And the flip side is all the faculty from Brown, they have a chance to go there, give lectures and mini lectures and mini workshops. So when I moved to Vanderbilt, I wanted something bigger than this. This is my home now. So I started by talking to Dr. Vermund, actually, and we did a trip to Jordan a few months ago with Dr. Douglas Moon, our chief of division, and Waleed Irani and Jeff Dendy. We gave a series of lectures in cardiology, and we met with the Surgeon General of Jordan, and we decided that we're going to be starting a bigger program, a bigger bridge between Vanderbilt and the Royal Medical Services and the Jordan University that would not only include cardiology, it's going to be including everything. Cardiology was the beginning. It's going to be similar, a little bit similar to the program with Brown and how it's constructed, but it's going to be including everything. And we're going to have the first trainee coming here in the United States that she has actual USMLE, so we're not going to have any problem with getting her or exempting her from a license because she's a trainee. And she's going to be trained in echo and transesophageal echo, which they have only one person doing that there. So she's going to be the second person. I'm sorry, I took much of your time. These small pictures, and these guys had the free ride on the SUVs we have there. But now, this is the way they looked when they came home. And this is Nashville Bridge, which I am happy to tell you that I'm going to make sure with Dr. Vermont and Dr. Gabby that it will end up here. Thank you.
Exactly. Conversations with the University of Jordan.
Exactly. Yes, and in Jordan we have the academic places are mainly the University of Jordan and Jordan University of Science and Technology and the Royal Medical Services. And we're going to focus, with the University of Jordan, we're going to focus mainly on the exchange students training program, in which we're going to make sure that our students, when they go there, they will be exposed to some training in the University of Jordan and in their own medical services. And definitely we're going to have some of our faculty going there to teach. In fact, come April, I'm going there with 4 of our faculty in medicine and surgery, cardiology and cardiothoracic surgery, to give many lectures there and workshop. And in May also we have 2 more going there to give workshops on PFO occlusions and stuff like that. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Joseph Smith from the Department of Urology. He participated in a program to introduce continent urinary diversion to Sierra Leone for women with fistulas that could not be repaired. Trained doctors in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and subsequently had one come over to Vanderbilt for 3 months. He intends to bring residents and fellows on future visits. Dr. Smith.
Thank you. Well, thank you for letting me speak here for a few minutes. You know, over the years, I've had the opportunity to do surgery in a number of different countries, sometimes as part of a visiting professor program, other times as part of a medical mission sort of situation. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Sierra Leone, how I became involved in going to Sierra Leone, what we did while we were there, and what we hope to do in the future. So I guess I like you. I'm going to Jordan in a couple of months, so I'm looking forward to visiting Petra.
Can you talk with us?
Let's see. All right, so Sierra Leone, I'm sure most of you know where it is, in West Africa, surrounded or bordered by Liberia and Guinea, kind of has had notoriety recently because of the civil war and the movie Blood Diamond, if you've seen that. But it has an interesting history. So it's a West African nation of 5.8 million people, a mixture of religions and no... religious strife whatsoever. So it's a good example of a country with various religions, but no issues whatsoever in that regard. The capital of Freetown was established in 1787 for formerly enslaved African Americans who fought for the British in the American Revolutionary War. And it gained independence from Britain in 1961 and then went through that horrible civil war, which ended in 2002. And they've recently had democratic elections with a fairly stable transfer of power. So at least in terms of any civil war or war-related activities, it's fairly placid there. And it's, you know, it's a country with enormous potential. This is actually a view of Freetown from where the hospital is, where I was working. So you can see it's well up in the hills over Freetown. And they've really got what potentially could be a beautiful coastal area. However... do they have problems? Because it's listed by the United Nations as the worst country in the world on their Human Development Index, which includes life expectancy, literacy, education, standard of living, and GDP per capita. So it's a place with just enormous problems, but like you might expect, wonderful people. You know, it's interesting. One of their problems is that their capital city, Freetown, is very inaccessible, because their international airport is located across a fairly large body of water, and they don't have any working ferries or rapid boats that they can use to get you there. So the only way to get from the airport to Freetown was these ancient Russian helicopters with these drunk Russian pilots up front that had to transport people. And interestingly, I was on the U.S. ambassador to Sierra Leone, was on the flight with me, and he said that he rarely leaves Sierra Leone because he was so afraid to get on these helicopters. And, you know, rightly so, both of the helicopters have crashed in the last 6 months and killed all the people, and I don't know how you get downtown now. Unfortunately, you know, I like African wildlife, who doesn't, so I wanted to see whatever they had there, and they were very proud of that. They said they had chimpanzees, and I said, oh, great, yeah, are they hard to see? No, they're easy to see. Well, can we go to an area where there's chimpanzees? Sure. There it is, poor guy. You know, this is the wildlife such as they have, so not much opportunity there. But what was I doing over there? It's no secret that vesicovaginal fistula is an enormous problem in certain parts of the world, and in particular in Africa. And a vesicovaginal fistula is an abnormal communication, a hole between the bladder and the anterior vaginal wall. It happens as a consequence of difficult and prolonged delivery and pelvic trauma, where basically the woman rips a hole between the bladder and the vagina. And, of course, the woman has no control over her urination then. It drips into the vagina. There's no sphincter to hold it, and so she has urine running down her legs. Fairly uncommon in this country, but it happens, and when it does, we fix it. It can be fixed by a transvaginal or transabdominal approach in most patients. But sometimes it's really bad, especially over there, and there's just an obliterative scarring process in the vagina that doesn't permit repair, or the fistula may simply just be too large or too proximal. There may be an associated rectovaginal fistula, and really the only solution for women like that, this, whether they're in Sierra Leone or in Nashville, is a supravesical, above the bladder, urinary diversion. 5 minutes, hurry up. Yeah, I'll be fast. And so the way you can do that is a number of different ways. One is an ileal conduit, where you take a segment of bowel, put the ureters into that, the lady has to wear a bag. Another one is to make a new bladder internally, which we do commonly here, but it's not appropriate for these women. So what we do is what's called a continent urinary diversion. Here's the new bladder made out of bowel. This is brought up to the skin, and she can catheterize. So I went over there as part of the, what's called the West Africa Fistula Foundation, which is based in Freetown. They have a very modest facility, but they work hard to try to take care of women with these fistulas. This is the doctor who had come and worked with us, and we've trained to do the fistulas, but the continent diversion she can't do. And they have a very modest operating room to permit a procedure of that magnitude, but very dedicated people. And this is just a picture of some of the women. But, you know, problem is that most of them are young women. This one's 18, but most of them have no idea how old they are because they don't celebrate birthdays and don't have any landmarks. But most of them are young women. This is just a picture of the continent diversion. Here is the stoma, which is going to be brought up to the abdominal wall. But that's a big operation to be doing under these circumstances. Here's a woman postoperatively. You can see there's a bunch of tubes that we have to worry about. This is into her pouch. These are the stents into the ureters. This is a drain tube. This is what she's going to be catheterizing through eventually. You see, just the collection devices weren't what we thought. But here's what the abdomen looks like afterwards. Kind of, you know, the pretty excessive scarring, but nonetheless, this is the opening through which she'll catheterize. She wears no bags or anything. And interestingly, this is a picture of the women I operated on. They all got dressed up in their tribal garb. Here's one of them able to dance 4 days post-op. However, and there's a picture of them more, it all wasn't that rosy because this is a big operation. When we do it here, we expect that a patient might lose 15 pounds or so. And if there's any sort of postoperative complication, they're going to require total parenteral nutrition to help move them along. And we don't have that opportunity over there. One of these ladies died. She got malaria postoperatively, or had malaria and had a malarial episode on about the third postoperative week. Temperature was 104. It was just too much of a hit for her. Another one had tetanus. Many of them have AIDS. I could talk about the obstruction problem, but there's no way to solve it over there. So we step back, and I'm not still positive that it's a good idea to be doing an operation of this magnitude with that degree of support or lack of support in a country like Sierra Leone. But we're continuing to work with them. We hope to go back over there with some of our residents and try to see what's going to really be the best solution for what's a, for a very desperate situation for them. So thank you.
Jay, I wonder if you could go back one slide. It's interesting how remediable some of those things are. Certainly a tetanus shot can be given, as we often do, before surgery here. Certainly antiretrovirals could be initiated if one had access to a CD4 and a simple screening blood test. The malaria could be screened for, and one could at least give suppressive dose of not curative. Sometimes it's not even advisable to cure somebody with malaria in an endemic area. The azotemia is a tougher nut to crack, I admit, but those first three infectious etiologies are remediable. So I wouldn't see them as obstructing your ability to actually pull this off. Now that you've learned that those three things are a problem, I think one could actually think that through and perhaps remediate.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, our problem is that these women, they just can't take a joke. You know, I mean, I don't mean that sound flighty, but I mean they can't tolerate any sort of post-operative complication. Their recovery is going to be rocky enough, and they're just going to barely have nutritional status to get them through. So even prolonged ileus could be fatal. I mean, we see people here, they have prolonged ileus, fine. We put them on TPN for a week, 10 days, and they're okay. These women wouldn't be. And these are just some of the things that I hadn't anticipated. You know, they called me and said one of the ladies was back in and had tetanus, and I don't have a clue how to treat tetanus. But you're right. But the azotemia is enormously remediable. Over there, I almost had to jump on a plane and go over there for one day to try to help out in one of these ladies.
One of our nutritional enhancement at the time that antiretroviral therapy started for AIDS patients, because there's a paradoxical response when the immune system resurges in AIDS patients in healthy countries. You can actually get sicker if you have a TB and you don't have a very strong immune response to TB. You can get sicker from TB if you restore the immune system with antiretroviral therapy, because now you get the inflammation from TB. That could kill you. So, and we've had high early mortality from initiating antiretroviral, and we think nutrition is a part of it. So this could be an even more comprehensive approach with the partnership to try to remediate some of these issues with anticipatory infection and nutrition guidance. But worth thinking about.
Yeah, no, I appreciate those comments. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think the emphasis would have to be, again, on the capacity building, because, you know, these people have to be recovering for quite a long period of time, and in many of these places, that's where they get, you know, nosocomial infections from just being in the hospital. So, you know, trying to build the capacity to improve the way that hospital care is done in those settings, I think, would be extremely important.
Yes, although, you know, there's a bunch of tribal taboos and all that sort of thing that limit it some. But this group, this West Africa Fistula Foundation, I think they're doing a great job within the constraints they have of seeing women with vesicovaginal fistulas and repairing the ones they can. Now, they get more and more, and that means more and more who can't be repaired. And is it a worthwhile expenditure of their resources to have me or someone else go do a big fancy continent diversion on a handful of them when those same resources might have been able to repair 100 fistulas in other women? I mean, that kind of question is not limited to this situation, but I wonder. We went over there in an exploratory way, and I'm still not 100% convinced that going back and doing more of them in this sort of an environment is the right thing. Even this operation, see, I want to do the one where they wear a bag. That's a simpler operation. It's going to be less likely to have complications. But
they don't want the bag.
Well, they don't want the bag. I think we could get them to accept. We could get them to accept it because their life is just so dismal right now. But if you don't have the appliances to fix that, it's almost mean to do that to somebody. And sure, while we're here and involved, we can get them the appliances. They're pretty expensive, but we could do it. But this is lifelong. And if all of a sudden this falls through, those women are just worse off.
I think I said this to you, but having been there and worked there, and one of the most, for all the war atrocities, one of the most lasting images were the 14, 15, 16-year-olds and younger who were complete outcasts because of the smell. And so I would say that one of the biggest frustrations we had is at that time nobody was repairing them. Nobody. So the fact that this is happening and that you are doing it, I with all the risks and the questions and everything else, it's got to be worth it to go back a couple more times anyway and continue to measure.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We intend to. And you're right. When you go over there and you see these poor women, it's pretty hard enough to do everything you can to help them, because they have, I mean, I couldn't imagine a more dreadful life. They're just absolute outcasts, as I say, the smell. You know, almost by definition, their child died during childbirth, so they're childless. They've all had genital mutilation. It's a pretty grim situation.
Well, that's why I wonder.
Oh, they did, but I didn't see myself as anything so wonderful, because I was worried about these women. Now, there's another one. I'm afraid she may end up dying. From, you know, this is a while ago, but she
you've got some ongoing issues, and it's just pretty hard to manage them from here.
It's just, I think they already see themselves as dead.
Well, I know you're right. Many of them commit suicide.
Andy, do you have any comments? Andy Norman has been doing BDM repairs for years in Nigeria elsewhere.
Yeah, that's, you know, Dr. Smith, that was a tough question. And, you know, what do you do to the ones that can't really carry the traditional surgery? And I don't guess there's any right answer right now. In Nigeria, we did a series of about 50 what's called a mines to pile where they, you know, break the urine out with the stool. And it might be a little bit more capable of getting them back into their home atmosphere. You know, the whole deal on Oprah was raising money, $3 million just from Oprah, to support women like, exactly like these that Dr. Smith did, where they've had some sort of diversion procedure in the international communities, raising up to send money to buy bags or to buy catheters and to have the expertise around. But in the case of Ethiopia, they're near the big hospital where there's always somebody that knows how to deal with the complications. And, you know, on Oprah, they call it the village of hope. But the people who've been there call it the village of hell. And they just say that you take a woman out of her natural environment and never let her go home again. That's not life. And, you know, so it's tough. I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is. I think we're all trying to find it.
Well, on a positive note,
you're right. The patients will line up. I mean, any kind of hope that somebody comes from outside and offers is hope, and they all want hope. And so,
well, we're up against this.
From them, even if they're the one who dies, you know.
Well, we're up against this in the AIDS field. Everybody knows prevention is where it's at. There's 6 new AIDS patients for every one who goes on antiretroviral therapy. But having said that, in 2000, reasonable people would have said treating AIDS persons with AIDS with antiretrovirals is hopeless in Africa. And today we don't feel that way. Right. I mean, in 2008, there are a million people in Africa on AIDS therapies. Alfredo lived through the creation of a program which was restored life to hundreds of thousands of Mozambicans, and I think these are worth struggling with. You know what I mean? I like what Carol said.
You almost have an alternative not to struggle with these issues. If everybody did what Dr. Smith has done and what I've done, and if everybody just went and made a difference for a few, the world would be a lot better.
Sure.
You get very discouraged when you think you could go over there and make a big difference in the country or a big difference in even a hospital, but you certainly can make a difference in a lot of the community. And I think the vision is to just get everybody to want to do that, you know, to do what he or she can to help and help find the right answers. You know, we don't know.
Well, we were impressed by your slide of the women who came to thank you. So.
Yeah.
Thanks again. Those of you who are still here are going to get an honorable recognition for your effort of staying the whole time. Our last speaker is Dr. Barr Weiss, who is a clinical psychologist at Vanderbilt, and he works in Vietnam, where he's set up a program to address children's mental health. And he provides postdoctoral training in clinical psychology here at the university, and he's helped establish a PhD clinical psychology program in Hanoi, Vietnam. Dr. Weiss?
I get the honor of being last, so I will skip through some of the things that I had planned initially. I'll briefly mention our corporate sponsors, which are NIH, to whom we're eternally grateful, or at least grateful till the money runs out. These are the Western faculty in our various programs. When we first started in 2001, when we were talking several years later with our NIH project officer, she asked how we had managed to accomplish all we'd accomplished with a relatively small amount of money. And my response was that we stayed in cheap hotels. And that was partly true, but the main reason we accomplished what we did, which has proven to be a very good strategy, is that you'll notice all these people, or if you know, all these people have Vietnamese last names. These are our Western colleagues from UCLA to the University of Western Australia. They're all born in Vietnam, and so they're very dedicated and work very hard and don't get paid anything, but they're very committed. So we've really, a lot of our success has been due to the fact that the people are very committed. The reason I'm as committed, too, is I'm not born in Vietnam, but I'll jump back. This is my older daughter who was born in southern Vietnam. This is my younger daughter, and then this is the two of them recently in Florida. So I'll skip through these. These are some of our Vietnamese colleagues. These are the institutions we work at, the main institutions in Vietnam. And the main source of our funding has been the ICORDA programs. Sten had one when he was at UAB. We've had two, and an acronym has to be one of the worst acronyms, but after a while you get used to it. The ICORDAs had two primary goals. One was to address global health problems by enhancing the research of collaborating U.S. and foreign scientists and to increase research capacity overseas. The first ICORDA we got was in 2001. It was a three-year planning grant. And our focus was on children's mental health. I'm a child clinical psychologist, and my research focuses on intervention research. So that was our focus in this project. And the goal of the 2001 project was to decide what the best methods were for training mental health researchers in Vietnam. And that was extended to 5 years with bridge funding. The ICORDA is an RFA from NIH. It's released once every 5 years, so you get one chance at it every 5 years. I spent 2.5 years on the second proposal, and it did get funded. And the goals for the one that started in 2006 are to develop a PhD clinical psychology program in Vietnam, and then also to develop a master's program in clinical psychology for dissemination of research findings. The people who go through the master's program will be clinicians. The people who go through the PhD program will be researchers. Very quickly, the first thing we did, which was very nice, we actually did what you're supposed to do, which is do a needs assessment, and we went to 26 different agencies around the country. I put these in. I know nobody can read them, but it's interesting to see the different names. There were a number of conclusions we came to from the needs assessment. The first was that professionals understood that mental health was broader than has been traditionally defined. There, traditionally, mental health was schizophrenia, mental retardation, and seizure disorders, and people did not link things like depression, behavior problems, drug abuse to mental health issues. But professionals did, but politicians and the general public don't. Professionals saw mental health problems as very serious problems. When we went through literally every school in every school district we met when we did this, said the biggest problem they faced was behavioral problems. It was not educational. It was the fact that they were having problems with the children's or students' behavior in the classrooms. People agreed that there was almost a complete lack of training and research in clinical areas for children's mental health. And despite this lack of training, people have been very eager and have begun establishing counseling clinics without any training, any expertise, or any real knowledge of what they're doing. And you have a situation that makes you want to do something very quickly because people are doing things that are, is from a professional point of view, nonsensical in terms of treatment. The people, however, are very bright and very dedicated. They just simply lack the training. So in the first project, what we did is we decided to try three different training methods and pilot them and see how they work. The first one was a two-week training seminar in Hanoi. And these are the various topics we covered. This is people during the break, taking it easy. And then the second involved training in the U.S. We invited two people over as a pilot who came here for 4 months. They took classes. They observed clinical interactions. They worked on various projects, worked on translating and adaptive diagnostic measures and a variety of things like that. And then the third approach we took was mentored research projects, and we worked with mid-career professionals and mentored them and supervised them in a variety of research projects. These are some of the projects. I'll skip through them. And that was the first project. At the end of that project, we had to decide what we wanted to do to come up with a sustainable approach to supporting and enhancing mental health research. And what we decided was the best approach would be to develop a PhD clinical psychology program. There are no clinical psychology PhD programs. There's one master's program, which has been supported by the French. The French have a very different perspective. They're psychoanalytic and non-empirical. When you get a master's in that program, there's one thing you do. You do one case study from a psychoanalytic perspective and present it to the faculty. There's no research training and no training in empirically based treatments. So that was our decision to do that. What we do with this is that we will bring over about four people who already have their doctorates, and they'll receive training here at Vanderbilt. We have the first one coming in a couple of weeks. We're also going to be training two PhD students in clinical psychology. These people will go back and be the faculty members in our clinical psychology program. We also are starting the master's program next fall. We'll be teaching the first set of courses in the fall. We will go back and co-teach them with a variety of Vietnamese colleagues in the university we're working at. And then we also have what we call a program fellows program, which involves mentoring mid-career professionals and providing them training and mentoring and research and a small amount of seed money for a research project. That's the two I-CORDAs. We also, as a consequence of these, we've gotten involved in a really wide-ranging group of different research projects. The largest one is a opiate addiction treatment program in Vietnam. The treatment there for opiate addiction involves being sent to a residential camp in a rural area where you stay for 2 years. The treatment consists of ideological education, why using drugs is not compatible with a socialist ideology, manual labor in a field which is not designed as punishment. We have a NIDA grant going in, and one of the reviewers wanted to know if working in the fields was punishment, but it's not. It's believed from a socialist ideology, manual labor is enlightening, and so part of what they do is work in the field for 5 hours a day. And then the other part is they get vocational training and small engine repair and things like that. This is a story Sten really likes, but when we first started talking with our colleague at the hospital, he said that there had been an NGO study and the relapse rate was 99%. And I said to him, well, what about that one person? What can we learn from him? And most of the drug abusers are males. He said, excuse me, the relapse rate's 100%. So he had been approached by the local authorities to develop a more successful and effective program. We adapted a self-help program called SMART, which is in the U.S. It's empirically based. We modified it. We made a number of modifications for Vietnamese culture. We've been running for two years, pilot groups in the hospital, in the community, in the drug treatment centers in the community. And we recently moved to another province to expand the program. And we had a NIDA grant that went in last time, and it's going back in a couple months. I'm always optimistic about grants, so hopefully it'll get funded this time. We have a large variety of other projects. One that's not on here, I think, but I'll mention because it's so interesting, is that do people know what mass hysteria or mass psychogenic illness is? That's when you have a bunch of moderately to large number of people who develop medical symptoms, but there's no explanation for it. And all indications are that there are psychological reasons for the medical symptoms. There was one in Australia about a year ago at the Melbourne International Airport where about 25 or 30 people got sick. They called in a toxicology team, emptied the terminal. They found nothing. There was one in Tennessee about 15 years ago at a high school here where there was a smell that came out of a vent. About 75 students got sick, were taken to the hospital. There was no medical reason. They checked for gas. There was no gas. So there's a variety of indications that it was psychologically related. You see this maybe once a year in the United States. It's not very frequent. United States has about 300 million people. In the last 6 months, we've identified 7 of these incidents in Vietnam, which is a country of about 80 million. So there's something that's different about that. And we now have a national network for assessing these. One of the students who's coming over in a few months is actually involved in this, and we're trying to identify why these schools are showing this and why specific individuals in the school show this. One of the reasons I'll say briefly is that a lot of Asian cultures, including Vietnam, are not psychologically minded. And what I mean by that is they don't make connections between events in the environment and their feeling and their behavior. So when something stressful happens, they'll experience the physical sensations but not connect it to the environmental event. And so they may interpret it as something physical rather than as something psychological. Another study we've been involved that has been looking at Vietnamese conceptualizations of child psychopathology. And what we find is that there are a lot of overlap, but there also is areas where there's non-overlap. One of the interesting areas has been that parents are very concerned about children who develop precociously, not just physically, but mental or intellectually. Parents, most people in the U.S., if their child is gifted and ahead of their peers, they're proud and they feel good. In Vietnam, parents get worried because they're concerned that the children will develop too rapidly and then begin to challenge their authority and the authority of adults. So that actually makes parents uncomfortable, and they see that as problematic. So we've looked at a variety of issues that are specific to the culture. We've looked at the epidemiology across the country. We're also particularly interested in mental health in the schools because there's not a good healthcare system for children, and so working through the schools is a more effective way to reach the children. I did mention the mass psychogenic illness. And this last slide, you could say either this is the future, and you could say, is this the future is open and exciting, or is it bleak and empty? And which do you think it is? Is it open and exciting, or bleak and empty? Okay. And the reality is, of course, they actually just put in a blank slide by accident that I hadn't realized that there was a blank slide. So I actually made it on time by talking quickly.
Thank you very much. Questions?
What was the language skill level that you need to be brought over for training in the U.S., the 4-month block folks?
Okay, it wasn't tremendous. They did fine in the classes except for one class where the professor spoke very rapidly.
Was that your question?
No, it was not. No, one of the things I have learned working there for 6 years is I've learned when I talk, if I need to, you talk slowly, and that becomes a habit, and I can do that most of the time. If I'm at a lectern, I talk fast. So. But it was their English was okay. The people are coming over. One of the people is a faculty member in a psychology department. They do not want him to leave because they know he's a good colleague, and so they have done everything they can to make him fail. They gave him extra work to make sure he couldn't study for the TOEFL or the GRE. That made it hard for him to leave. The only reason he's coming over now is because it's Chinese New Year's and the university shuts down for a week, so he can come over, but they've done their best to make him fail, which shows you kind of the level of some of the political things that go on. So,
I may be wrong about this, but it seems to me that it's a little bit unusual to have a developing country that is so interested in clinical psychology that they're interested in a PhD program.
One of the things that when we went there in 2001, very few people were interested in psychology, and then within 2 years, it became such a hot topic. And one of the things you see in Vietnamese culture is people are very sensitive and to what's going on, and they will emulate and model people. You see, when you see in Vietnam, there's clusters of types of stores. All the stores that sell tires, or they sell wrenches are in the same place. In the U.S., they're spread all out. It's because I see you doing and you're making money, so I do the same thing right there. And I think the same thing happened. It's really, for some reason, became a very big topic. I had one person who was this somewhat annoying American who, at a meeting, said, "Don't you think there are more important things than mental health?" But actually, according to WHO, 5 of the top 10 non-infectious health burdens are mental health related, so that it's very cost effective in the long run in terms of the dollars you put in, you get out a lot more than you put in.
Well, where I was going with that is it seems to me that a lot of the people who have had a crisis where that has resulted in refugees and have experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, in some cases like the Bosnians and other people like that, have realized by virtue of their experience the importance of addressing psychology.
One of the reasons that they may be is because they have a two-child policy. It's not as strictly enforced as China. But if you're in the government, if you have 3 children, you get a 10% pay cut. The 4th child, you lose your job. So most people have 2 children. And what happens is, from the traditional family of 6 or 8, you go to 2, so you tend to focus all this attention on this small number of children. The children get spoiled. The children of the families in the either political or economic elite, a lot of them are out of control because the parents work really hard. They work 15 hours a day. They're both working. They're both professionals. The kids are spoiled. They give them whatever they want. And some of them get involved in drugs, and some of them get involved with racing motorcycles without brakes at night, and they get arrested by the police, and of course they're let go because they're part of the political elite. But they see the problems with their kids, and they don't know what to do when their kids are doing drugs. They can keep them out of prison, but they don't know what to do. So it's really been the political leadership and seeing the problems in their own children, I think, that has sensitized them, rather than the masses being exposed to different kinds of trauma.
Are you going to stay only in Vietnam, or are you thinking you might try out paddling something similar in another country?
For the moment, I have developing contacts in China and Thailand, but for the moment, given my limitations in language and time, I probably am going to stay there. I'm certainly open to collaborating with the drug program and things like that. Sten and I are talking about it. An HIV intervention in China. So, but my own focus will probably stay in Vietnam because of my own personal ties.
This network of Vietnamese Americans who are in psychology is quite extraordinary. I mean, that one slide. How did you figure this out? How did you identify this network?
There are not a lot of Vietnamese-American psychologists. Like most refugees, when you come here, you want a good-paying job, and psychology is not a particularly good-paying job for how long you go to school. People tend to go into business or medicine or engineering. But I'm a member of the Asian-American Psychological Association. When I first wanted to do this, I talked with one of the people I knew. He recommended a woman. Let me go back to the people. Vicky Ngo is a former graduate student of mine. She came here in 1999. She's now at UCLA. The woman at the bottom, Quinn Nguyen, is a current graduate student of mine. Jane Tram is a postdoc. The other people are people I met through the AAPA. And when I need somebody, I send out something to the listserv, and people are, love to do this. So, and it really worked. It's because the people, they work hard, and we don't get paid anything. With international grants, they don't let you pay U.S. collaborators because the money's relatively limited. So everybody's works hard. We get our expenses paid, but we don't get paid anything. So. Well, I hope the NIDA one gets funded. So. can that actually will pay people? Because people like Vicky, she lives in L.A. She makes a reasonable salary, but it's not reasonable for L.A., and she needs more money. So.
Okay. I think we're not going to bother you with any final comments, but we have a reception, so please follow us to the atrium. No?
No reception.
No reception.
We knew people wanted to go home.
Oh, okay. So go home, Ben.
Favor,
go home. Thank you.